Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do more than 200 years of clever aphorisms and popular sayings encapsulate the history of the United States? From "We shall be as a city upon a hill," through "Don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes," to "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," we Americans have seized upon certain phrases, making them part of not only our speech, but of our culture. And Jan R. Van Meter has put the history of many of these well-known phrases into a new book called "Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History." Jan, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you very much.
First of all, what is the difference between a slogan and a catchphrase?
Well, slogans, the word slogan actually comes from the old Scottish word for battle cry, and they really are calls to action, whether they're explicit, like "don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes," or they're implicit. Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, is implicit since the word "vote for" isn't there. And slogans are kept or really remembered by the nation or the culture, either because of the importance of the moment or the event that they encapsulate, such as "a house divided against itself cannot stand," or of the value that they teach, that the culture wants continued, like "give me liberty" or "give me death." Although not always, there are some slogans whose survival remains somewhat of a mystery. Tippecanoe and Tyler II, for example, I think survives only because it rhymes and it has meter.
Yeah, far better remembered than the men that it promoted.
Oh, definitely. Particularly since Harrison, the Tippecanoe part of that, died after a month, and Tyler is one of our more forgettable presidents.
Well, explain how Harrison got connected to Tippecanoe in the first place.
He was the general who commanded the forces against the American Indians at the Battle of Tippecanoe. And during the election of 1840, they used the slogan to make him sound like a real regular guy and a real hero, when in fact he was just another American aristocrat like his opponent, who's grew up on his father's plantation, and his father had signed the Declaration of Independence, and Harrison himself had graduated from Princeton, so he was hardly one of the working poor. Let me just go to catchphrases. Catchphrases aren't really calls to action, but they sort of they ingrain a statement of belief in a value that we want to remember, or they're just in the culture and are still thought of. They can be negative, like "frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," or "nice guys finish last," or they're positive, like "three yards in a cloud of dust," or "Kilroy was here." And in many ways, they're sort of more common, but they also come in and out of the culture as the values come in and out.
It was really interesting, Jan, that it seems that you found that in a fair number of cases, the phrase that sticks in people's minds isn't exactly the thing that was originally said. "Damn the torpedoes" is a good example of that.
Yeah, it's in a way, we've been playing a national historical game of telephone because they get passed down largely orally and until sort of the later in the 20th century, and even still, they get changed because they're more easily remembered in some way. My favorite one is "no taxation without representation," which, as far as I can tell, was never actually said or used, although the value, the idea was current in culture pre-revolutionary times. But clearly, America, it survives because Americans just basically, like everybody else, doesn't really like taxes very much. But the last thing that Sam Adams, who was sort of the firebrand in the northern part of the agitation for rebellion, the last thing that Sam Adams wanted was representation in Parliament, since the Americans would get 13 representatives in Parliament and be buried and forgotten. So he wanted something other than representation. He wanted his own parliament.
And he was a guy, Samuel Adams, who knew a little something about how to brand things. He was the one who came up with the term "Boston Massacre."
I did not realize that.
Yeah, there's a great new biography about him that you can check out. This phrase, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes, not necessarily created, this surprised me, in the Revolutionary War. It was sort of standard practice for 18th century soldiers.
That's exactly correct. It was the standard European warning to the troops to hold their fire, since you had two lines of armed soldiers marching on each other, or at least one marching on another that was entrenched, and they were all pretty nervous, and so they were told just to wait and wait and wait until they could be absolutely sure of hitting their targets. But it was used again, most likely, on Bunker Hill, actually on Breed's Hill, since the battle was never fought on Bunker Hill.
Did Nathan Hale really say that he regretted having only one life to give for his country?
You know, for decades, if not for well over a century, it was doubtful that he had ever said it. After all, the people who were present when he was hung were two British officers and a hangman, and it was hard to understand how anybody would have passed that along. And if they had, why it wasn't seized upon by Washington, but particularly by his, if you will, speechwriter, Tom Paine, as a way of rallying the sort of forces in America around the effort. And then about 20 years ago, a diary was discovered by one of those British officers who recorded essentially those lines, which were probably taken by Hale at the last moment from a play that was very popular at the time, and then communicated to when that same officer came across the lines to exchange information about prisoners with the Americans, and this officer told one of the people he had met with about Hale. Now, the reason it was not seized upon by Washington most likely was it was a completely failed spying mission. Washington did not wish to acknowledge that it had ever taken place. But the man who had heard it on the American side, later to become a general, General Hull, told one of the early American textbook writers, Hannah Adams, of the story. And she credits him with the story. And that's how it gets in. It actually gets popularized first in the textbooks the kids used in the early 19th century.
Well, in some ways, that's very interesting, Jan, because in some ways, that's the exception. So many of these phrases that really do come with these wonderful little history lessons wrapped up in them, as you write them here, don't necessarily get explained in our history textbooks anymore.
That's right. I'm a child of the 1940s and early 1950s, and that is the way we learned history. And that's the way kids' history books were written, popular history books were written. But the style, that kind of style of history writing, or teaching history, went out in the 60s and never really recovered, for good reasons as well as for bad, but largely for good reasons, because history can be much more complicated than these slogans. But at the same time, it does mean that we have tended to forget the meaning of many, if not most, of these slogans and catchphrases, although they're still used. Obviously, Governor Palin's use of "Say It Ain't So, Joe," however sort of inaccurately used during the debate, was one of those times.
Yeah, that initially came from Shoeless Joe Jackson.
That is, well, it's supposed to have come from Shoeless Joe Jackson. If you read the newspaper story in the Chicago newspaper where it appeared, it's my suspicion that the newspaperman made up the story. Suspiciously, the newspaper delivery boy who is supposed to have said it is never actually named.
Just some boy that was conveniently there to make
exactly.
This great quote.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Jan R. Van Meter. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. Let's talk to Bill in the Mid-Cities. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I was curious. Now, Jan, I know you've done research on Revolutionary War and presidents and such. My curiosity is, I heard a commercial the other day about a British tea. And I'm thinking, since we threw a bunch of tea in the Boston Harbor, what was the brand of the tea, if you even know it?
Products were not branded at that time. They were, particularly tea, was merely a commodity. And, if you know, the kind of tea, whether it was, you know, Chinese tea or Indian tea, would have been noticed. But there, we did not have brands, largely because food was just a commodity. It was not a commercial product in the way we know it.
And that, I guess, happened once things started to be mass-produced for convenience use. Things were more often, more likely to be branded later on.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I suspect, like, although I can't prove it, that the first thing really to get branded is liquor.
You know, here in Texas, the way the phrase sticks with us has had some impact on the way we view history. We all remember Sam Houston saying, "Remember the Alamo," but we've paid a lot less attention to Goliad, which, of course, he noted and remembered in the very same breath.
That's correct. And it is, you know, I taught in Texas for 4 years, and Texas is still remarkable for the extent that it still teaches its own state and perhaps national history, if you go back then. And so, yes, Goliad is quite significant, but for the rest of the country, there's the Alamo and what else?
And why do you think the other half got cut off? Do you have any theories about that?
I'm not sure. It certainly is simpler. I mean, if you're going to pass something down largely orally, it sticks with remember the Alamo, remember the Maine. It's instead of remember this and that and something else.
General Sherman is credited for saying war is hell, but he said it, this is fascinating, long after the last shots of the Civil War were fired.
Correct.
What was he concerned about?
Well, he was speaking to, he had been invited to speak to a group of his veterans, people who had fought it under him in Ohio. And he talked about how wonderful those days were. But then he said, but we all know, and only we know, that war is all hell, boys, and we'll never forget it. The Civil War is particularly an object of fascination in this country, and there's probably more books written about it than any other subject in American history. But for those who don't know it that well, it was the most brutal war that we've ever fought. And if you count the deaths on both sides, America lost more men in that war than it's lost in all the wars before and since combined.
And obviously Sherman had experienced so much of that firsthand and was concerned that there were too many glorious stories, particularly on the victory side.
I think that's correct. He's unusual for a general because he remembers and cared very much about the casualties that he was incurring. He was willing to wreak the destruction he did in his march through Georgia, because it was the only way he felt that the war would be brought to an end.
Jan R. Van Meter is my guest. He is a former CIA intelligence analyst and public relations professional. He has also worked as a professor of English. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. If you want to join the conversation, perhaps ask a question of your own about a famous slogan or catchphrase, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jan R. Van Meter. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. You can join us this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. Let's talk about Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus. This is such a great story.
Yes, it is. It's for a change, it's actually a story which actually happened. A little girl in New York wrote a letter, probably helped by her father. She was young, to one of the newspapers in New York, saying that all of her friends were telling her that there is no such thing as Santa Claus. And, you know, it's a very, very old tradition for one's friends or one's older brothers and sisters to ruin your life by telling you there's no such thing as Santa Claus. But she said that her father said that if it appeared in the New York Sun, it would be true. And so she wrote a letter. The answer was contained in an editorial, which came shortly after she sent the letter. But interestingly enough, the letter was sent and answered by the editorial in, I believe, September. So she was worrying quite early. The editorial was entitled, Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus, as it still is. And I think that's probably the most reprinted editorial in the history of the United States. What I found interesting when I went back to the original newspaper to take a look at it is that it's buried in the middle of, must be, 15 other editorials in small type. But it was so popular that, as I said, it is reprinted, I know, here, and I'm sure everywhere, right about now, every year.
It is a beautiful little essay.
It is a wonderful essay, and it is interesting if you read it, because it's really a defense of religion, and it's a religion of Santa Claus, but it's also a religion of giving and of the importance of seeing the spiritual side of things rather than just the material side of things. When she wrote it, you know, Americans in many ways invented Christmas as we know it, and people started worrying even in the 18th century about the material aspects of it, and that people were having to go broke getting presents for all their friends and all their families. But at the same time, it is a tradition which is continued because it is important to us, even though to some extent it's become a civic and even a secular holiday. But it retains the kind of spiritual values of, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
Yeah, it's extraordinary in that, for one thing, it reveals that even people in the late 19th century were worried about cynicism. And you think if they were worried about it then, my goodness, what do we have to think about now? And then the idea, it's so foreign to our culture today that any responsible parent would tell his child, if you see it in the media, it must be true.
That's right. And it's not that there was that much more belief in the truth of something in the newspaper, because newspapers then were far less credible than they are today. But it is an interesting idea that if it's in print, it must be true.
As a parent, I have to wonder if Dad was just stalling and hoping
Should
buy him a little time.
I'm absolutely sure you're correct.
Jan R. Van Meter is my guest. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. Let's speak next to Don in Fort Worth. Hi, Don.
Hi. My question has to do with corporate slogans that might better be described as propaganda, to put it nicely. I live in Fort Worth, Texas, which is the first large city in the United States to allow natural gas production in the city limits. And we have been inundated for the past couple of years with corporate slogans that even go so far as to say natural gas is good for the air, even though scientific evidence has proved quite the opposite. But I'm interested, there's one slogan that you see everywhere that's clean burning natural gas is the phrase. And I discovered that it was actually created by a branch of the corporate of the gas drilling industry, the Gas Corporation of America. And yet most people believe that gas is in fact clean burning, when in fact when the whole picture is considered, it's about as dirty as coal. And I was wondering what you what your comments might be about corporate slogans such as that, and how they are being popularized, and people see them as the truth, when in fact they're probably not.
Thanks for your call, Don.
You make a good point, but consider that all slogans and catchphrases are propaganda. Each one of them tries to teach or perpetuate an idea, a concept of action that whoever is speaking wants you to pursue. So that give me liberty or give me death is as much propaganda as gas, the clean burning fuel. One has to consider the source, and there's no question that corporate slogans, and we can all think of a zillion of them, come to be viewed by, if you don't think about them, as the truth. Quality is job one at an automobile company has been skeptically received for decades. But at the same time, you know, if you think about the one ad slogan which I write about in the book, which is "You've come a long way, baby," most of us have forgotten what that was a slogan for, and it's come to stand for the triumph or the coming triumph of the feminist movement in the United States.
And it actually sold cigarettes, right? Virginia Slims?
Yeah, Virginia Slims, yes, which were invented or created to take advantage of selling products, particularly for women, and the fact that they're just as health-destructive as every other form of smoking was beside the point, and even though it was known when it was created. But there were a whole series of ads, and then, of course, Virginia Slims sponsored the tennis tournament, and that lasted for a very long time.
How did we get Kilroy was here?
That's a wonderful example of one which is really popularly created. When the GIs were going off to fight World War II, they started to see written on walls, on the sides of tanks, on buildings, the phrase "Kilroy was here," and there was often a sort of cartoonish-like face. The British had something similar, which might have been taken and then adapted, and all it said was something, what, question mark. But for the Americans, it was "Kilroy was here," and it would pop up everywhere. It was seized by the troops, who were, for the first time, we had a mass civilian army, huge numbers of people who were not professionally trained soldiers and who had a divided feeling about what they were doing, not in terms of fighting, but the whole concept of Americans being orderly, responsive to commands, all dressed the same, was not really of something which charmed everybody.
Strengths were not known for in this country.
That's right. And so the statement "Kilroy was here" was this imp that would pop up everywhere, that was created by and for the army, the enlisted men themselves. There is a story which is probably apocryphal that one German general said if they captured anyone in Europe named Kilroy, he wanted him brought immediately to general headquarters so he could be interrogated personally. After the war, there was a search for Kilroy, and the War Department announced that no such person ever existed. They never had anybody named Kilroy in the Army. And so the local New York newspaper did a contest for who could find Kilroy. And a letter came from a worker in a Boston shipyard whose name was Kilroy, who said that when he started out in the early 1940s, even before we got into the war, and to inspect ships, people would pester him about whether they, he had inspected their work or not. And he was having to do jobs two or three times, inspect them. So he started writing, Kilroy was here, so that they would know that he'd been there and stop pestering him. And it spread that way. Now, other people came up with other ideas, but if there is a possible source for it, it's probably Mr. Kilroy up in the Boston area.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jan R. Van Meter is my guest. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. Let's go next to Travis in Dallas. Hey, Travis.
Hello. Hi. I wanted to know, you mentioned Shoeless Joe Jackson, how that whole story with the newsboy may have been made up out of whole cloth. And I was brought to mind of the theory that the original Jack the Ripper letter that was sent to the Whitechapel police that actually called himself Jack the Ripper was also may have been made up by a reporter. I was wondering if you comment, like, how many of these slogans and phrases in history are really just made up out of whole cloth by people who just want to make a good brand?
Very few of them, actually. Kilroy, well, in a sense, of course, they're all made up, but you're saying made up by as sort of a creation of something apocryphal. Very few. They all arise from things people said or came close to saying. They are usually responsive to what's going on in the society and voice them very well. But there aren't many. Chris mentioned Damn the Torpedoes, Full Speed Ahead, I believe. And now, there's a big question of whether in the middle of the Battle of Mobile Bay, whether the commander could ever have said, Damn the Torpedoes, Full Speed Ahead, since Farragut was in the middle of an extraordinarily noisy battle and full of ships trying to struggle to get inside. And he was a very Christian man who did not believe in swearing and sort of famous for that. And it is possible he did not say it. It was not recorded. There were no newspaper men on board. But it does seem to have been passed around through the enlisted men in the Navy. And finally was recorded about 10 years later. And his son believes that he said it. And in the moment, heat of battle, he may well have said it. So is that made up? Well, to the extent that people make up things to reflect how they were feeling or how they think other people were feeling when they were there, yeah, it might have been made up. But as somebody sitting in a obscure office saying, boy, this is a neat thing to have him say. No, I don't think so.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. It's very interesting. We all think about Theodore Roosevelt saying, speak softly and carry a big stick, but it wasn't so much a one-time pronouncement from him as a sort of theme throughout his career.
Yes. It's also curious that no one's ever found the part of West Africa that came from, or even if it was, where he got a hold of it. But yes, he first used it in a letter in 1903 when he was governor to a friend describing how he had just won a legislative battle with the state legislature in Albany. But of course, nobody noticed because it was a private letter. Then it was used when he used it in a speech when he was vice president under McKinley, and nobody paid much attention because who pays attention to vice presidents? And finally, it was used in another speech when he was president in Chicago again, and this time it made the headlines. It made the insides of the newspaper. It made a box sort of pull out from the story, and then the newspaper started internalizing it. So that 3 days later, there's a headline inside the paper which reads, speak softly and wear a large mustache, says the police commissioner, I think it's a police captain, to his men on the South Side. And more and more people started using it around the country, even in the middle of the Democratic candidate, the man who nominated the Democratic candidate that year, said that this, you know, his desired candidate isn't somebody who would carry a big stick, but he believed in diplomacy. And that has continued ever since. And you heard Senator McCain use it, because Senator McCain has Teddy Roosevelt as a hero, as he is many people's heroes. He's probably sort of the most diversely accomplished president we've ever had.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Marcia in Navarro County. Hey, Marcia.
Hi. Are you familiar with an expression, tell it to the Marines, or go tell the Marines?
Yes. That's one of my favorite.
What does it actually mean?
Well, I can tell you what it means. What it means is, if you think I'm not dumb enough to believe that, go tell it to the Marines. It's actually an old British slogan. And every British, back in the days of iron men and wooden ships, every British warship carried a contingent of Marines who were there to during battle. They were there to keep order, but during battles, they would climb in the rigging and snipe at people on the opposing ship. Marines were generally gotten from rural parts of England, had never seen the sea before, and this whole thing was absolute mystery to them, this being on the water in this little ship. And they were always told the wildest stories possible, because the sailors would just entertain themselves with how gullible the Marines were. So go tell it to the Marines comes from that.
Jan R. Van Meter is my guest. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll hear a little bit about float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jan R. Van Meter is my guest. His new book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. You can send us email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Love the story in the book about Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, and float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. I was surprised to learn he wasn't the first person to say it.
The person who came up with it was Bundini Brown, who was as good a phrase maker as Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, ever was. And he was pretty great. Bundini Brown once said, when you're out of town, you're out of town. And it's something that people have been using ever since. But Muhammad Ali is a fascinating person. He's a testament to the belief that if you live long enough in the United States, you become a hero to everybody. at the time, he was a hero to many people, but not a huge number. African Americans have been kept out of boxing since Jack Johnson's time in the 1910s, and when they were sort of finally got back in. They were all in the model of Joe Louis. They were very quiet, very downplayed. They were very gentlemanly. They were low-key. And Muhammad Ali, from the time he was 12, started forecasting how the outcome of his amateur bouts would last. And he was once recorded saying, this guy must be done. I'll stop him in one. Getting about with Sonny Liston was difficult because Cassius Clay had such a reputation that nobody particularly wanted to fight him. And he started taunting Liston and making it hard for Liston to refuse until finally, when Clay had jumped into the ring after a Liston fight and on national television, started making fun of Liston, Liston insisted that he was going to fight Clay. The way he did it was, as he had done so many times before and so often afterwards, was to get inside his opponent's head. And he did such a good job this time that at the weigh-in before the bout, they were making such a demonstration of how crazy Cassius Clay was that everybody was convinced that he was terrified of Liston. And in the middle of it, Juan Bondini, Brown, and Clay would start yelling, "Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee," and lots of other things, too, like, "I'm really the champ," "Tell Sonny I'm here," and so on. And in fact, when the fight started, at least one sports writer noticed that Cassius Clay was in complete control of himself. And when the seventh round came, Liston refused to come out for the fight. He had given up. And, you know, Clay then Ali, because shortly after that fight, he converted to be a Muslim. And he had ended up having to win back the championship two more times. And he did it. He's the only person who's ever done that. And he has become, even in the midst of his illness, sort of a treasure of the nation and revered by almost everybody.
And this one sports writer, Mort Sharnick, who happened to notice and surmise that Cassius Clay was indeed in full control of his emotions, saw him across the room winking.
At Robinson, yeah. It was quite wonderful. And nobody else seemed to have noticed. You know. So, he always knew what he was doing, and he was always supremely supremely confident in his ability to do what he said he could do. Unlike so many, things that get remembered is when somebody says what he's going to do, like Joe Namath saying that he was going to win the Super Bowl. It never gets forgotten, and it really doesn't matter if you've done nothing else since.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Michael in Dallas. Hello, Michael.
Hi, I have a question. I've heard this phrase put a couple of different ways. The phrase that I'm curious about is "in like Flint," and I think I've also heard it pronounced "in like Flynn." And "in like Flint." I'm wondering if you can enlighten me on the origin of that term.
At least the way we say it up north is "in like Flynn." But I don't know who Flynn is any more than I know who Willie is, who in the phrase, "you give me the willies." I just don't know. I have a feeling it's one of those things that goes back into deep time.
Or it may just rhyme, and so it sounds good, and sometimes I guess they just emerge out of nowhere.
Yes, it's possible.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. How did Harry Truman decide that the buck stops here?
It was always his belief that when you had authority, you had responsibility. And that he was ultimately responsible for everything that happened. But one of his friends who worked for him in the White House was visiting a Texas penitentiary. And when he was talking to the warden, he saw on the warden's desk a plaque which read, "The buck stops here." And he brought it back and gave it to Harry, who was so pleased with it, he put it on his desk. Now, the question is, everyone's wondering, has wondered since, what does it actually refer to? And most it seems to be generally accepted that it comes, it's a term that's reflected from poker. And Harry was also an avid poker player. But it's another one of those things that since you don't use it, the buck was always put in front of the person who was dealing, and you don't do that anymore, I gather. So I'm not 100% sure, but that's where he got it from, was from a warden in a prison in Texas.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Maybe the most misquoted final line of a movie in American history.
Well, it's not the final line.
It's not. That's what I mean. People think it, they say the final line of Gone with the Wind. And it was, in fact, Vivien Leigh who got the final word.
That's right. And that one lives on, too. Tomorrow is another day. And I, in order to write that, I not only researched the movie and the novel, but I actually watched the movie again because it is a tendency that you remember what you the way you want to remember it. And I think also the role of Rhett Butler is so powerful that he tends to overwhelm Vivien Leigh in the movie. Although she does have the last scene in the and the last silhouette in the movie.
And what had it been decades since you'd seen it last?
Yeah, I don't think I'd seen it in probably 20 years. And it's still quite a wonderful movie. And, you know, it's also the first movie that where an African-American won an Oscar. But what I didn't know, and I found fascinating, was the movie played in England throughout the war, and the Nazis banned it from France, because they didn't want a story of people triumphing over occupation being seen by hundreds of thousands of French people, which is understandable.
In full Technicolor.
Yes, exactly.
Is there, in fact, a most misquoted famous phrase that we all tend to say wrong that stuck in your mind?
That's interesting. I can't.
Nothing jumps to mind.
Nothing comes quickly to mind.
Had you been collecting these for years and years just as something that interested you, or did you have to sit down and undertake the project of going and researching almost everything that appears in the book?
With one exception, which is actually the first one, We Shall Be as a City Upon a Hill, of all the ones that occur up until about 1950, I learned as a kid, and I had never forgotten, and all I had to do was sit down with a pad of paper and just start brainstorming, and all I could remember. And then the ones after 1950 or 1960 also came easily to mind because I was actually sentient then, so that was fairly easy. I didn't think of the We Shall Be as a City Upon a Hill until a friend of mine suggested that it was important to get in Mr. Gorbachev tearing down this wall, because after all, President Reagan had also said, and I should have this in my book, We Shall Be a Shining City on a Hill. And when I started doing research on that, I discovered that Ronald Reagan did not, in fact, make that up. It had been said in a variant form, a changed form, in 1630 by John Winthrop, who was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He said it in a sermon. And it's a slogan which has been changed over time, but was basically forgotten, except by scholars and perhaps and religious historians, until Jack Kennedy picked it up before he became president in a speech in Massachusetts. And then Reagan picked it up, changing it. Each person changed it slightly to make it fit what he wanted to say. Ronald Reagan emphasized the shining city, but also saw Winthrop as what he called a freedom man, that he'd come to this country to have freedom, which is not really true. He came to have freedom for his religion, but he wasn't particularly interested in anybody else having freedom for their religion. But he was still an amazing person who, and it was an amazing venture that he undertook. What's important about that slogan is that the Pilgrims, people who were called the Pilgrims, the Puritans, came here to preserve a particular form of Christianity, what they felt was the pure form of Christianity, why they're called Puritans, so that when England was destroyed in the cataclysm, which was sure to be brought by God because they were not following the pure form of religion, they would then be able to go back and reconstitute the nation. When the time came that they could go back after the Cromwells seizing the throne, many of those who had survived decided, we like it here. And they stayed, and Winthrop, in fact, was one of the people who stayed.
It is remarkable, some of these, the way they come back in history. When I read, "If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve," I, of course, thought of LBJ.
Yes. That's absolutely true. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing that the man who did say it did not become, was not nominated because he was a terrible politician. In fact, he hated politics so much that when he was head of the War Department, he moved it to the Midwest just so he could get out of Washington, D.C. But I had forgotten about Texas is particularly good about coming up with wonderful lines. It's one of the things I loved about living there. You know, there's the vice presidency ain't worth a bucket of warm spit, which I always figured that somebody had prettied up before it saw the light of day. And then there's always hook 'em horns and one riot, one ranger. You know, Texas and politics have, Texans enjoy politics more than almost anybody else I've been.
Yeah, I think we like the fighting as much as anything else down here.
I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Well, it's really a fascinating book, and there's a lot in here that we didn't have a chance to talk about today, Jan, but I really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Well, I appreciate you having me on the show. I've enjoyed it.
Jan R. Van Meter's book is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Famous Slogans and Catchphrases in American History. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for joining us, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.